Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Amazon canceled its plans to build a corporate campus in New York City. It's an abrupt reversal that comes after the tech giant received intense criticism over the $3 billion the company would have received in government incentives, among other things. New York Times technology reporter J. David Goodman covered the news. He joins us now. Welcome to the show, David.
No, thanks for having me, Ann.
The deal was said to be foolproof. What actually happened?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the deal was not ever sort of signed in stone. This was a memorandum of understanding that they had with the company and the city and state. And what ended up happening is that the company got more pressure pressure that it wasn't expecting to change the deal after they had already kind of reached what they figured was a final offer to the state and city. There was a lot of pressure locally, especially in Queens, where elected officials and union heads wanted the company to make further concessions, especially in hiring of local residents of public housing, and then in their unionization or anti-unionization policies. And the company, after getting heat in the press and before the city council in New York City over the course of about 3 months, abruptly pulled the plug on Thursday.
What were they missing in their planning process that brought this out, you know, after the fact?
One of the problems that they ran into is that the deal was struck between the state and the city, but between the governor, Andrew Cuomo, and the mayor, Bill de Blasio, and it was done essentially behind closed doors. All of the sort of negotiations and the trying to get Amazon to the city was done, you know, under seal, under a kind of non-disclosure agreement that the company had had with all the cities that it tried to, that it was looking at for its second headquarters. And so it became clear very late in that process that New York was going to be one of two sites selected. And they hadn't really had any opportunity, because all this was going on behind closed doors, to tell anyone in the public. So they sort of made the announcement to the public all at once, and it was a very large number of jobs, which they figured would be enough to convince people to support the deal. But in New York City, the problem that we have right now is not primarily a lack of employment. There's quite a lot of employment in New York right now. The problem is in crowding, is in the subways that are not working, is housing that's too expensive. And when people heard 25,000 jobs, possibly as many as 40,000, they thought, well, where are all these people going to go? And that's the kind of the heart of the protest. Was it's not so much that people don't want jobs, it's that they feared that it was going to cause displacement and turn New York into San Francisco.
Huh. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about what happened with Amazon in Long Island City or Queens or not. My guest is J. David Goodman. He's a New York Times technology reporter. He covered the issue. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Well, what do we all learn from this? What have other cities learned? It makes me wonder what will happen the next place they go.
Right. I mean, I think what folks on the left seem to have taken from this is that, you know, they have more power than they thought they did. This is especially true in this neighborhood of Queens where this happened. Now, this is right adjacent to the congressional district that was won by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Mm-hmm. And that victory happened in the midst of so Amazon starts its process of looking for a second headquarters in late 2017. She wins in the middle of 2018. Several months later, the state Senate in New York State turns Democratic for the first time in decades. And suddenly you have an empowered left in that particular corner of Queens, and Amazon comes in, and sort of the ground had shifted under their feet. They didn't really fully understand the politics. I think even the governor and the mayor didn't fully understand how much things had changed. They sort of figured there would be noise and there would be a lot of complaining, like there always is in New York. It's not uncommon for big projects to get a lot of people upset.
Right.
And they thought they would ride it out. But Amazon is not as used to that and wasn't as comfortable going before the city council, being in public and sort of defending their policies and having subjecting themselves to that kind of criticism. People that I've talked to who cover the company in Seattle have talked about how they really just aren't used to that. They're not used to being forced to explain themselves in public, and their executives looked very uncomfortable whenever they did it. And so I think the lesson for people that are opposed to these kinds of deals is to really hold the company's feet to the fire. the lesson for cities that want to, entice businesses like this to come, I think, is that you really need to know the community that you're moving into and work with them in advance. And one of the stories that I did before this all fell apart was looking at how Google had moved into its area of Chelsea in Manhattan. And they didn't have any real tax incentives, and they grew very slowly over time. And by the end of, I think, 10 years, they'll have almost as many employees in that area as Amazon was planning on bringing to Long Island City. But it happened very organically, and I think that is probably what we'll see happen a little bit more, not the splashy, let's build a second headquarters, but we'll come to the neighborhood, we'll get to know it, we'll grow sort of with it.
Was Amazon too greedy?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of people are wondering whether the whole plan to the public nature of their search for a second headquarters was ultimately a mistake, that it seemed fun and interesting. And obviously a lot of journalists covered it as a big sort of, where are they going to go? Almost like a reality show.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in the end, that whole plan backfired on them, and it really played up the nature of these economic development processes and policies, where you play one city and one region against another. And I think we're at a moment where that sort of a competition is distasteful. And you see, the Foxconn plant, they're sort of billions of dollars in Wisconsin sort of going up in smoke. And sort of these incentive deals don't look as good as maybe they once seemed. And so I think Amazon, went out and was very public with this. And I think had it been less so, it maybe wouldn't have encountered the same problem that it had.
Back when they first announced the decision to go to Long Island City and into Virginia and split the headquarters as they have or plan to, a lot of people wondered, why in the world did they do this like this in the first place? And it was brought up that they collected a lot of data about a lot of big cities around the country.
That's right. It looked very smart at the time. It seemed like Amazon had outsmarted a lot of people, and had maybe they always were planning on going to New York and Virginia, or at least to the East Coast, but they were able to learn a lot about a lot of regions that they could use later on when they're trying to place smaller distribution centers and other fulfillment centers that they have all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
So they sort of looked savvy in the beginning, but I think if their plan was to come to New York all along, this way of coming didn't do them any favors. I think they probably would not have encountered the same sort of, anger and resistance had they said, we're going to bring 1,000 jobs here this year, and then the next year we'll have, a few more, which was their plan. They weren't going to bring 25,000 jobs all at once.
Right.
It was going to be a process of a decade or 15 years. But because they made such a big deal out of what a huge boon this thing was going to be and what a major development project this is going to be, even in New York, which has its share of large companies, people got a little bit worried.
How have people been reacting there with the news that they're pulling out?
It's very mixed. I mean, you have people who were opposed to it all along, especially activists on the ground in Queens who are cheering it. There was a sort of impromptu celebration among local advocates in Queens after it failed. And then you have the elected officials, even some who were very against it, who have been blaming Amazon for sort of pulling out and not giving them a chance to negotiate. I think they thought all along that by opposing the deal, they would get a better deal. They didn't really anticipate that it would result in no deal whatsoever, even if some of their public statements said otherwise. And so you see a lot of attacking of the company. The mayor has come out and really lambasted Amazon and tried to attack them as being part of a corporate elite that he's been criticizing. The governor, for his part, hasn't attacked the company so much as the state Senate Democrats, who were the ones that ultimately put up a roadblock that made Amazon question its desire to come to New York City. So different people have been looking at it through different prisms, but it hasn't at all been a unified response in the city. You almost have more infighting now, Democrats sniping at other Democrats and people in Queens being mad at other people in Queens. And so it's not one big happy celebration that they're not coming.
What about the union factor in this, organized labor? What was their role in all of this? What were they trying to get out of it?
So there are different factions of labor here, and some of them were supportive of the deal. Some of the office worker unions, the ones that do some of the cleanup in office buildings, they were supportive. The construction trades were supportive because they figured that they would have some part of the construction that would go on there. And then you had a union for a very vocal union for the for retail workers and wholesalers that was from the beginning very opposed and got some others on board, such as the Teamsters in New York. And they were quite against the deal, and they became even more so after, during a city council hearing, one of the Amazon executives said that they would not, essentially said they would actively oppose any efforts to unionize in New York, as they've done elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But getting him sort of on record and saying that in public was unique and something that Amazon hadn't really, had sort of tried to avoid doing. And so suddenly they were in this posture of much more blatantly being anti-union. And the unions then took that as an opening. And there were actually some negotiations that were happening kind of down to the wire right before this all fell apart. And it seemed as the unions were hopeful that they could actually reach some kind of compromise or some that there was some progress in the conversation. And it's unclear whether that progress actually caused Amazon to pull out. But they certainly have been have not unionized their workers or haven't allowed the workers to unionize in any of their various businesses, and they didn't seem interested in letting that happen in New York or allowing that little opening that maybe could have opened it elsewhere in the country for them.
Are they being as open about what the next step is as they were about the the apparent process of weeding through all of the applicants before?
I think what they've said is that they're not going to do it again, that they're not going to open another search. So I guess that's a tacit admission that the first one wasn't the best idea. And they said they're not going to find another second part of the second headquarters, that they're going to grow in the places where they already have offices, including in New York, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Because they have about 5,000 employees in New York already, some of whom work for a fulfillment center. But they also have people that work in their advertising divisions and who do fashion. And they have an office in Midtown Manhattan, and they could grow that. They could grow offices in Brooklyn. They could do it more of the Google model, which I was talking about before, and sort of organically grow inside of New York City. And maybe, who knows, in 15 years they'll get to 25,000 jobs without any incentives, in which case maybe these opponents will have been proved right.
And in Virginia, is it possible that they're going to grow more there?
They do have the leeway to go, I think, up to between 30 and 40,000. I forget what the exact number is, but they can grow pretty large there, too. So, yes, I think maybe it'll be that, you know, that will be their quote unquote second headquarters for the time being. But they haven't been that explicit. Even before all this happened, they hadn't fully detailed what they were going to be doing in Virginia versus New York, what kind of jobs would be in each place. I think they're still figuring some of that stuff out. So, no, they haven't said exactly what they're doing next, but they said for sure they're not launching another nationwide search.
And has Virginia responded in any way? Any people in Virginia seeing this as an opportunity to push more for more or step back and, you know, stand down?
That's interesting. I mean, there are some groups that I've seen talk about you know, hey, look what they did in New York. Maybe we could do something similar here. But the dynamics are quite different there politically and sort of the kind of space that it's moving into, as far as I understand it, is more of an office park setting than Long Island City was. Long Island City has changed a lot, even in the last 5 years. It had been sort of light industrial. But mm-hmm. in the last 5 years, really, last couple of years, you have many more people moving in. There's huge high rises that have gone up. It's quite a fast gentrifying area. And so you had a lot of new voters, a lot of new people, and a lot of change there. And so I think the situation in Virginia seems a lot more stable, and I don't think there's quite the sort of political foment that you had in New York that would undo this.
J. David Goodman, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That's J. David Goodman. He's a New York Times technology reporter. He's covered the Amazon's decision to back out of building its part of its next headquarters in Long Island City, Queens. Coming up, we have more Tech Tuesday for you. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Amazon and Google for years have collected data whenever someone uses a smart speaker to manage a door lock or a front light. Now the tech giants want a continuous stream of information from those connected smart home gadgets, whether or not you asked Alexa to get involved. Bloomberg reporter Matt Daly recently wrote about the issue. We'll post a link at WOSU.org/allsides. Matt joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Google and Amazon have been doing this for how long?
So you got to go back, I think, to the beginning when they started rolling out their smart speakers. I think most folks are familiar with the cylindrical devices. You can ask to turn on the lights or do trivia. At the very beginning of that, 4 or 5 years ago, in the case of Amazon, a little bit more recently in Google, every time you ask them to do anything, say turn on that smart light you have connected to the system, Alexa, Amazon's Alexa would go and ask the smart light bulb makers' servers, hey, is the light off or on? Those servers reply back, hey, we're off, and then the change would go on from there. Now they've sort of reversed the relationship, asking those devices to report in kind of at all times.
And what is that just a constant stream every time, whether you ask it to or not, right?
Yeah, exactly right. So, whether I ask Alexa to turn on the light, if I get up and toggle the switch, if I use some kind of remote control to change the light bulb, in any of those cases, Amazon and Google want an update pinging them saying, hey, the lights just changed. Here's how it changed. And they keep a record of that.
Why do they care?
So part of it is convenience and kind of making the system work better, because step-by-step way this used to work that I described at the beginning, where they'd have to go and ask another server whether the light bulb was on or off. That was kind of a cumbersome technological process, so this speeds things up, right? It makes it less likely that the request will fail. And secondly, they kind of want to be able to piece together user patterns, right? How often do you lock your door at night? And if you, say on the 10th day in a row after locking it 9 days in a row, you don't enable the bolt, they want to be able to proactively say, hey, are you sure you didn't want to lock the door tonight? And kind of provide the kind of helpful information that can only be gleaned, they say, from collecting this kind of data.
Where does the role of advertising come into all of this?
I think that's the biggest question analysts are asking about this. Amazon says they don't use this for advertising. This data is only to make their services better. Google didn't talk much to me at all about their program. But I think that the speculation is because both of these companies have, giant advertising franchises. Obviously, Google's is a good deal bigger rather than Amazon's. Mm-hmm. That eventually this data could be used to inform sort of targeted advertising based on how you use your home devices.
Can you opt out of this? Can you tell Amazon or Google, I don't want you to do this?
You can't. Both companies currently have privacy dashboards online where you can go and delete, both voice recordings and collected smart home data, right? All those records of, when you turned on your TV and such. But neither currently offer an option to sort of proactively unplug a device from that kind of reporting to begin with.
And how do companies such as 23andMe factor into all of this?
I'm not sure. That really didn't come up much in my reporting, but I think it's another good example of, the way consumers don't really think about, how, their interactions with these big companies are creating a set of data that's potentially valuable to, the company that's going to be custodian of that, right? When you plug in all your smart home devices to Amazon and Google, you're thinking, hey, this is a cool, party trick and way to turn on and off my stuff. But you're probably not thinking how useful that data is going to be on the back end to somebody else.
Is the data that we're talking about only related to smart devices, or is it all the trivia I ask Alexa or what I listen to on the radio?
It's both. Alexa has known what you listen to on the radio and known the trivia questions you ask for some time. And kind of what's new here is that smart home piece, right? Like in the last year or two, Amazon and Google have started pushing to collect that smart home data as well and to sort of add that to the list of things they know about you.
How extensive now is the use of smart technology? Do we know?
It's kind of hard to piece together. There's conflicting surveys on it, but smart speakers are growing pretty fast. It's something the tens of millions of units sold a year at this point between Amazon, Google, and Apple in third place. And somewhere about a quarter of users of those speakers use them to control some other gadget, right? Whether it's a TV or a smart lock or some other home appliance.
And the data, is it identified as your data or is it anonymous?
So both Amazon and Google haven't really taken us under the hood and say how they store this stuff. You know, mm-hmm. Certainly when you go onto your privacy dashboard that both companies have and see what they have about you, that's associated with your account, right? It's identified to you by name. You know, what they do with it behind the scenes, it's unclear. I'd assume that both, if you put the question to them, would say they, when they analyze or work on making their services better, that they do it in an anonymized way. But, you know, again, that's me speculating. They didn't tell us about that for the purposes of this story.
We are talking about Amazon and Google and how they track how your smart devices are working, when they're working, what they're doing, whether or not you're communicating with them through Alexa. My guest is Matt Day. He is a Bloomberg reporter, and he's written about this issue. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you unhook your devices from Alexa, is that it? Then they can't collect the data anymore, right?
That's exactly right, yeah. And that's really the only way to turn off, you know, this kind of proactive status updates is to unplug it from the system entirely. And that's one of the critiques that some of the companies that make smart devices have raised with Google and Amazon is, you know, hey, why not offer customers, you know, some more fine-grained controls to turn off that kind of reporting for devices you just don't want sharing that information?
Because they may stop buying them.
Yeah, exactly right. And there's also a case to be made from Amazon and Google's perspective that, you know, they want the system to work well. And to do that, they need to have updated information on, you know, what things are doing connected to the system. You know, there's some disagreement about that, but
yeah.
You know, I think there is a genuine desire on the part of the big tech companies to improve the services.
Right, but the question is that you said the disagreement is over whether they need to track all your data in order to do that.
Yeah, exactly right. And how much granularity they offer to customers in terms of controlling what devices share what data.
Do we know if some customers are turning it off?
No, I haven't found that in my reporting. It's in most cases, I'd imagine that most users of Alexa and Google's Home Assistant haven't really gone into their online dashboard and seen, you know, hey, what does this device collect about me? A lot of people, you know, frankly, don't care. And many of the people who would be concerned about privacy, surveys show, don't buy these devices in the first place or turn them off or don't mm-hmm. connect anything to them.
And what about lawmakers? Are they looking at this as they begin to try to stitch together some kind of pattern or template for regulation?
I think people are definitely looking at this. You know, one of the things that's come up in our reporting on this story is the differences between the U.S. Data collection privacy regime, which is pretty lax compared to, you know, the general data protection regulations rolled out in the European Union, where, you know, frankly, the storage, collection, and analyzing of smart home data and all sorts of data are under a much stricter regime than they are here in the United States. And these companies, you know, obviously because they operate over there, opt into that standard there.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if it doesn't inspire them to rethink not letting people opt out here if it's headed in that direction.
It's unclear, and I think, you know, both companies you know, are very sensitive to the impression that, you know, they're putting a always listening microphone into your living room, and they're aware that sort of the concerns around privacy of that is potentially one of the biggest risks of this, you know, growing and lucrative business for them. So I got to think if this became a sticking point for consumers, they'd you know, they'd certainly take that into account and potentially change their policies on data collection and use.
How popular are smart speakers now?
It's basically the hottest corner of consumer electronics. But again, that pales in comparison. You know, they're not outselling TVs or smartphones or anything. It's something on the order of tens of millions of smart speakers selling a year. But, you know, kind of unclear how what portion of the population owns one.
And where are they headed? I mean, are they eventually going to have smart speakers just stuck into TVs and just stuck into appliances?
Yeah, one of the new trends that, you know, both Amazon and Google are pushing is trying to invite, you know, device makers, whether it's, you know, Whirlpool or Samsung, to embed their voice assistant inside that device made by that other company, right? So mm-hmm. that, you know, you don't have to necessarily have a speaker. Just this voice assistant is kind of an ambient software that can follow you from device to device, and the only thing you need to do to invoke it is say its name.
Mm-hmm. Like She or Her or whatever that movie was.
Exactly right.
And anyone else out there in protest land saying this has got to stop in the United States?
Not that I've found. I mean, obviously, the some of the digital privacy groups are concerned in general about, you know, the expansion of smart home devices and the fact that a lot of the information is round-tripping up to the cloud and back, and there's some security concerns folks have about that. And I think there's also kind of a community of tech tinkerers and enthusiasts who have been working on, you know, smart home and home automation stuff for a long time. They've taken a different approach, right? They want to, you know, store all this data locally rather than, you know, ship it up to the cloud and Amazon and Google servers anytime anything changes. Certainly from some of the tech enthusiast community, there's a different model being used.
Outside of the Bill Gates of the world, who I imagine live in smart homes, you know, outfitted, you know, dressed to the nines in smartness, how typical is it that homes are being built with this kind of technology built in?
People are increasingly taking advantage of that. I know Lennar, the giant home builder, struck a deal with Amazon, you know, sometime in recent years to you know, equip some model homes with Alexa and Amazon Echo devices. You know, there's also a push to design homes and market homes and new subdivisions as having, you know, Wi-Fi connectivity throughout the house and, mm-hmm. and the neighborhood. You know, there's definitely the folks who are trying to sell you on new real estate are trying to add, you know, these smart home components to their pitch.
And cars as well, right?
Oh, certainly. That's one of the things we saw from Amazon. You know, they've the last 2 years now held a big new device unveiling in the fall. And one of the highlights last year was a device that essentially turns your smartphone and your car's speakers into an Alexa device on the go.
Okay. Well, Matt Day, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Matt Day is a Bloomberg reporter. He wrote about how Google and Amazon are collecting your data, even when you're not telling your smart device what to do. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley from Android Central, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The speaker and headphone company Bose now manufactures sunglasses that double as headphones. Joining us now to talk about that and more tech news is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. So this is sort of a backdoor way of getting to the whole smart glasses thing, isn't it?
Sort of. It's important to understand that over the last couple of years, Bose has done some kind of weird new things with their audio equipment. We had a thing come out almost 2 years ago that was almost like a horseshoe that you wore around your neck that was just speakers. They were just loud speakers that you wore around your neck to have loud music with you instead of headphones. And they actually kind of sold pretty well. There were people who were very excited about having what was essentially a small boombox that you wore around your neck. But they were a little on the heavy side and pretty expensive, given that they had the Bose name attached to them. So there was this goal to have these outdoor audio devices that were more about, you know, having everything integrated into one piece of hardware than it was, you know, being the loudest thing or you know, kind of the flashiest thing. And that's where these Bose lenses came from, or Bose frames, I'm sorry, is the name of the glasses.
They're called Bose frames, right. How do they work? Where are the speakers?
So they're actually in the arms of the glasses. There's one on each side, and they're very difficult to see, actually, when you're looking at the glasses. It's not immediately obvious where they are, and they just look mostly like a normal pair of sunglasses with arms that are a little thicker than you might normally expect for a pair of sunglasses. They don't really have the Bose name splashed on them anywhere, like a set of Oakley glasses or anything like that. But when you put them on and you have music playing, as soon as the glasses kind of rest on your ears, you are just filled with sound. It's really kind of amazing that, you know, I have held these glasses up to my face and could not hear the music playing, even though I knew that it was playing music from my phone. And then as soon as I put the glasses on, it was as though there were speakers all around me playing music. It was really kind of amazing.
How do they do that?
These tiny speakers are built specifically to push sound in one very specific direction. And that direction, based on the angle of the glasses, is directly into your ears. So as soon as you have the glasses seated in the correct position, these speakers are just very focused on delivering sound in that one direction. And by working together, it creates the kind of stereo experience that you're used to with headphones and things like that. But it's still, there's nothing in your ears. So you really just kind of feel as though this music is coming from all around you.
Are the sunglasses any good?
They're okay sunglasses. You know, it's kind of interesting that the glasses themselves don't have a polarization filter on them. Oh. And currently there's no option to have a prescription put in them, which are two things that personally I look for when going for sunglasses.
Right,
They're still nice sunglasses. They look pretty nice. They're a little on the generic side. They're kind of matte black with a glossy black option. There are two different frame designs. One's a smaller design that has round designs for round frames for smaller heads, and then there's a more boxy looking design for larger heads. But they're really kind of generic looking sunglasses. They could definitely be a little better in that department.
Huh. And what are the negatives? I mean, just that sunglasses are okay, and that you're limited.
The sunglasses are okay, and you have to keep in mind that, you know, these are sunglasses. They don't transition into normal lenses or anything. They don't have any kind of special abilities when you're indoors. So these are really great replacements for your headphones that you can only wear outside during the day. You know, so if you want to listen to music at night, you would need a separate audio device to do that. Or if you wanted to listen to something indoors, you'd have to be the weird guy who wears sunglasses inside. So it's you know, kind of a toss up back and forth as to how useful they are for long periods of time. But if you spend a lot of time outside, or if you go for extended bike rides like I do, then they can be useful. The other thing to keep in mind is that they don't charge through a normal plug that you would see on a phone or something like that, because, you know, sunglasses are small. These are a magnetic thing that charge with its own separate kind of special cable, which means if you lose that cable or you don't have the case for the glasses, then, you know, when the battery dies, you're kind of out of luck, because these aren't sold in a whole lot of places. So, you know, you can't exactly step into Walmart and pick up another thing to charge it with.
Well, how much would I pay for these if I did purchase them?
If you did want them, they are $200, which is definitely on the expensive side for really nice headphones. But the design here is really kind of impressive. I really found myself enjoying them, as limited as they are. They're probably not something that I would recommend to a ton of people, but there are definitely a specific group of people that I feel like would really love these.
Like who?
People who just spend a lot of time outside. You know, if you live on a beach and you walk around a lot, these are probably really great sunglasses for you.
What do you think they portend for the future of glasses and using glasses as, backpacks for technology?
So Bose has been talking a lot about what's called an audio augmented reality platform, and we haven't seen a lot of evidence of this working quite yet, but it's supposed to, you know, kind of connect to your phone and use some of the smarts going on in your phone to deliver, you know, more accurate walking directions or maybe an information platform where you can kind of speak to Google Assistant through your glasses and things like that. So this has the potential in the future to be, you know, not the Google Glass style smart display that you would put on, but still something that is similarly intelligent at some point in the future. Just definitely not right now.
Hmm. What do you think? Is it going to be a good market, or is this just something they're throwing out there to see if it sticks?
I think we've got a couple of companies who are really interested in audio augmented reality. We're also seeing Apple kind of thinking about doing similar things with its AirPods, where the AirPods themselves are kind of a computing mechanism. So I think that this is something we'll see a lot more of in the coming year, as opposed to kind of the straight up computer that you wear on your face with a special display. And that I think could be really interesting, but it's going to be about a year before we start seeing that stuff be really interesting, I think.
How do you think the AirPods have done, by the way?
I think it really depends on where you are. It's really kind of a fascinating conversation that I have with people that I work with. If you go to a big city, San Francisco or New York or something like that, you don't really see a lot of them. It's kind of walk around and people watching, you would expect in those places where they're so heavily marketed. You see, you know, big billboards for AirPods all over the place in places like that. And you don't see a lot of people wearing them walking down the street. But here at home, mm-hmm. I live in a pretty rural area. It feels like a lot of people around me have them and use them all the time. So it's really hard to tell.
What do you think the difference is? Why do you think that is? Because we see them a lot around. I see them a lot around here, too.
Yeah, I think it really comes down to, people who are able to or decide to buy them when they buy their phone. I don't think there are a ton of people who walk into an Apple store specifically to buy AirPods. Mm. And so, it may be a little different in cities where, the rush to upgrade you always see in places like New York where there are people who line up, 200 deep to get a new iPhone when it comes out. It could just be that rush causes a delay in that, that secondary purchase. Whereas in a more rural area like this, you kind of walk in and take your time and make that purchase a little slower.
Yeah, I don't think of Maryland as rural, but whatever.
Well, there are definitely rural areas to it, and I live in one of those areas. But no, Maryland as a whole is definitely more city-like.
All right, so the LG Gram 17, there's been a review. It's a big ultrabook. It's light as a feather. Tell us what you know about it.
Yeah, so we have this kind of constant fight to make things lighter and thinner across all forms of technology. And usually, in order to get a laptop lighter and thinner, it also gets smaller. So you see, the Surface Go from Microsoft is a 10 or 11 inch machine, and you see Apple's standard MacBook is another kind of very small 11 or 12 inch machine. LG decided that it wanted to do something that was an ultralight but also huge at the same time. So you have this LG Gram 17, which is kind of a misleading name because it definitely does not weigh 17 grams. It is a 17 inch laptop that is designed like an ultralight machine, and it actually weighs almost 3 pounds. But for a 17-inch machine, that is really, really light. And in doing so, it actually didn't sacrifice a ton of performance. You still have a really nice screen on it. You have the hardware inside of it is definitely a higher quality. This is one of the few 17-inch machines that is light enough that you would consider, kind of making a portable machine where you would take it to a coffee shop, just kind of on a whim, the same way that you would an iPad or a tablet or something. And I thought that was really interesting.
I thought it was interesting what they did with the keyboard. Didn't they shrink that one down?
The keyboard is shrunk down, and this is kind of a pet peeve of mine for a lot of 17-inch laptops, because a lot of 17-inch laptops have the number pad because you have more space, so you can put a bigger keyboard on there. Mm-hmm. And the number pad on a keyboard often shifts the actual typing keys on a keyboard over to the left, yeah, which is off center from where the trackpad is. And that drives me crazy because it's asymmetrical. And for some reason, I crave symmetry in my life. It is a personal flaw. But this keyboard is shrunk down. It does not span the entire width of this 17-inch design, so it feels a lot more like a smaller keyboard, or really just kind of a more narrower keyboard, which makes people who are more comfortable with the smaller laptops that exist right now able to use this without feeling like they're kind of stretching their hands out.
Aren't they kind of small people?
I do not consider myself a small people, and
okay.
I definitely prefer the smaller keyboards to type on. I feel like it goes either way. And this is kind of a funny argument that I get into with programmer friends of mine who, prefer the biggest keyboard that they can get their hands on, even when they are small people. They talk to me like I'm crazy because I don't want the largest and loudest keyboard that I can find. But yeah, I definitely enjoy it.
What do they like about a large, noisy keyboard?
I really think it's just what they're used to.
Yeah.
A lot of kind of older programmers grew up with, not necessarily the IBM Model M keyboard, but something in kind of that vein. And there's something kind of tactile to typing on a physical keyboard that has a response where it pushes back at you.
Mm-hmm.
And when you type for an extended period of time, having that push response is actually better for your fingers. So there is some small ergonomic arguments to be made, but really, I think it's just that they like them to be loud because loud noises are fun.
What does this cost?
This laptop here starts at around $1,600.
Ooh.
It's definitely, you know, this is designed to be not an inexpensive machine. No, and then you rarely find 17-inch laptops that are, especially ones that are equipped like this. This is pretty reasonably priced for the hardware that's in it, but it's definitely a very specific kind of person wants this computer. Someone who really wants to be portable, but also really wants to get a lot done.
And what don't you like about it?
I think my least favorite thing about this particular design is that the way that this is set up, in order to be kind of light and thin, there's not room for a more capable graphics card. And that means that there are some things for me, like photo editing is a little slower on this, video editing is a little slower on this, and I probably wouldn't use this to play a lot of games on. So this is definitely more aimed at kind of a professional space where you kind of aren't doing a lot of those things as opposed to an artistic space.
Let's turn to Jump Force Review. It's Shonen Jump's 50th anniversary celebration, and every review I read was bad.
Yeah, this is really kind of fascinating. This is a game that has been kind of awaiting its arrival for a really long time. And in order to be excited about it, you kind of have to understand not necessarily Saturday morning cartoons, but a lot of kind of comic stuff over the last 20 years, things like Dragon Ball and Naruto and My Hero Academia and a lot of these names that you either hear and recognize or don't. Are all coming together in this one fighting game. So we've had fighting games in the past where, you know, Marvel versus DC or Capcom versus Marvel, where, you know, these kind of these game franchises that are a lot more popular to American audiences have come together to, you know, to form kind of one super game where you can take things from your favorite comic or TV show or video game and kind of put them against one another. And this is another one of those style games, but using characters that have been around for, in many cases, you know, upwards of 20 or 25 years and have developed just kind of massive audiences to themselves, and putting them in this game where they can fight in this very kind of, I don't want to say realistic, but it feels like when they are fighting that you are actually watching a show of them fighting instead of watching a game of them fighting. Mm. And so that ends up being kind of a very exciting thing. Unfortunately, while it is very pretty, the actual mechanics around doing things like starting an online match with someone or getting into kind of a tournament with a group of random online people and things like that, none of those things are great. They're not particularly well done. And while there is a story mode to this, it's really just kind of boring. And the reason that you would pick this game up, if you were to pick it up at all, would be if you are fans of these shows, and what you really want to do is sit down with two or three of your friends and pick your favorite characters amongst the roster that they have and fight each other for a little while and then kind of go and do something else.
Because it's not that engaging.
Because it's definitely not that engaging unless you have another person sitting with you that is also very excited about the things that you are excited about.
So did you find anybody like that?
My daughter, my oldest daughter, for very different shows, you know, because I grew up with the Dragon Ball series and she grew up with Naruto and Death Note and things like that. So it was kind of fascinating to see, you know, the characters that she got excited about and picked were very different from the ones that I got excited about and picked. And then on several occasions, because I am spectacularly bad at fighting games, she got
really?
Very excited about beating me. I've always been excited about them. I like watching people play them, but even as far back as the Mortal Kombat system that was at the grocery store or the convenience store down the street from my house when I was 10, I've always been terrible at them. I've always loved playing them. I have poured so much money into arcade games that I've been terrible at throughout my childhood and then eventual adulthood. You know, I've never been good at them. And so it's one of those really funny things where she adapted to a lot of those things very quickly and was able to beat me just about every time after about 20 minutes of gameplay.
Does it surprise you? I mean, how do they test games? Who tries them out? How does that work anymore? Do we even know?
A lot of times the game companies will have internal testing teams where they're tasked with testing, you know, kind of very specific components. And then we've kind of evolved that a little bit where, you know, there are trade shows almost where you'll be able to go and get an early look at a game and you'll be able to test it out and offer feedback. And game companies really appreciate and work with that feedback before the game comes out to make changes to make sure that the game is more effective. So it's a bunch of different things that gets done.
So how do you think they missed the mark on this one then?
I think this comes down to a lack of understanding of how people are playing online games and understanding that they needed a story mode, but did not really want to spend a lot of money on a story mode. Because there's so much history within all of the different, games and comics and shows that were put into this that you could have created a story mode with not a ton of effort. It just really feels like they didn't try.
It's the usual prices for this?
This is a $60 game. It's available for the Xbox and the PlayStation and the PC. And you can play online, but you probably won't for very long.
We were talking about Amazon and Google collecting, scraping up our data when we use them for our smart devices. The Amazon Echo input is the next, is a successor to Chromecast Audio. What are we talking about here?
So a lot of times you see the Amazon Echoes and the Google Homes, they are speakers that that you set up somewhere and they listen to your commands, and then the quality of the speaker matters because you can have you can have something that you prefer for music that plays, or you can have something that's just a very simple speaker that sits somewhere in a room and doesn't do a ton with music. The Echo input does not have a speaker at all. It is specifically designed for connecting to your existing speaker. So if you have a nice stereo system that you're really happy with, but you wish that you could stream music from it easily, then the Echo input is what you would get for not a lot of money in order to connect that existing nice speaker system to the larger kind of Amazon ecosystem, essentially.
How does it compare to Chromecast?
So the Chromecast Audio doesn't have its own microphone system. You are connecting a small little hockey puck to an existing speaker system, and then you are using your phone. So the whole Chromecast system is you have an app on your phone, and you say, instead of playing music on my phone, play it on that thing over there that's on my network.
Okay.
And that is a great tool, but a lot of people have – one of the great things about the Echo ecosystem and the Google Assistant ecosystem is being able to use your voice instead of having to go through your phone. So you can say, play this playlist, and have that just kind of start happening.
Well, what about the Echo input? What does it cost? What are its odds for success?
Well, so the Echo input is $35, and on price alone, there's a pretty reasonable chance of success here, because Amazon has demonstrated that having the inexpensive system for getting people hooked into Amazon has been very popular. Their Echo Dots have started at $50 and have been their bestseller year after year. And this is less expensive than that. I'm a little concerned that people will buy it and then be confused that it does not have its own speaker. And so wonder why they can't just plug it in somewhere, unless Amazon does a much better job explaining that this is designed to go with things and not something that you just buy and set up.
And it's also another way to collect data.
I mean, yes, anything that connects to the internet is used to collect data from you at some point. And you can either control that through the tools that are available to you, or you can not use it at all.
All right. Not a lot of choice there. Russell Holly, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate your time, as always.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly. He's contributing editor at Android Central. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.